Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated February 8th, 2016. We will begin today's reading on the front page with an article headlined, Weaver Gets Stress Relief. Subtitled, Age-Old Craft Looms Large in Decatur Woman's Family Background. From Decatur. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. At first blush, that may not immediately sound like music to weave rugs by, but Johnny Cash's classic Folsom Prison Blues sure twangs the warp for Decatur resident Lisa Rashi, who has a wooden loom double-parked in her basement. With the man in black belting out his angst-ridden hits in the background, Rashi makes the solid maple loom get up and boogie as she pumps pedals and slams back on a beater bar to knock her latest creation into submission. It turns out that weaving on a human-powered loom is far from a kind and gentle way to make things, and so musical accompaniment that hath charms to soothe a savage breast doesn't really cut it. Tunes with backbone and spirit are the way to go if you want to set your threads on fire with heavy-duty creativity. Yeah, I've often got the music cranked up, says Rashi, 52. You need something to kind of get you going, something with a beat, and I listen to a lot of Johnny Cash, nothing quiet. Rashi comes from a long line of Northern English weavers whose mystic chords of memory wind back through more generations than can easily be counted. She learned the art at the knee of her grandmother, Marge Meisenheimer, who became her mother after adopting her. Meisenheimer only gave up weaving herself 10 years ago as her eyesight began to lose its thread. She's now 103 years old and still missing her loom like mad. Oh, I loved weaving, loved it, she says, replying to questions yelled into her ear by her daughter, her mind still sharp. I loved everything about it, but especially doing something different, something new. And now she does it, she added, indicating her daughter, and she's good. She was a good learner. Rashi sells her rugs and other creations on online craft sites, but makes her living as a junior high English and science teacher at Decatur Christian School, wending her way home after a long day threading enlightenment into ruffled young minds. She finds some time spent at the loom with Johnny Cash usually helps knit up the raveled sleeve of care. I think it's her way to kind of step away from kids and stress, says David Rashi, 51, her husband of 27 years, and she's also good at it, and she loves it. Her progeny range from 6x6-inch mug rugs to stop your coffee cup making rings on the furniture, $15 for a set of four, up to 48x24-inch rugs that might sell for $50 to $60. Raw weaving materials range from strips of torn-up jeans to even discarded Indian saris. Rashi plays a big part, says a big part of the fun is hunting fabric supplies in thrift stores or collecting them from friends who always put something aside for the material girl living in a material world. Rashi says she can almost feel the weight of her ancestors gazing down on her as she beats and pedals her way through another colorful rug, crafted with love by hands guided by the genetic wisdom of centuries. And then one of the warp threads suddenly decides to snap, fraying the edge of her nerves because it can take hours to set up a loom and get it ready with a complex cat's cradle of intersecting threads. The weaver teacher says such occasions can leave the surrounding air clothed in a rich tapestry of ragged and heartfelt language as she struggles to pick up the pieces. But then the added strain of enduring multiple thread breakages in a single sitting, a rarer, although not unknown, occurrence, can leave her with no choice but to seek a remedy undreamed of in her ancestors' philosophy. I get up, leave it all, and go watch some TV, Rashi says. This article is accompanied by several photographs, one Rashi holding some of her wares, titled Rashi Shows Up shows off some of her stash of materials she uses in creating rugs. Another photograph shows her sitting at a very large loom. Lisa Rashi's basement is filled with materials, yarns, and looms as she continues the family tradition of weaving. And finally, a photograph with baskets full of all different kinds of materials titled "Weaving Supplies Fill a Wall of the Basement in Lisa Rashi's Home." The spool rack on the bottom left was made by her grandfather and has been passed down to her. From the local pages, article titled "Schools Inventing Inventors, Little Bits Inspire Young Students." Article by Valerie Wells, staff writer at Herald and Review. This is from Decatur. Christelle Harding's original dream was to provide little bits to every third grader in Decatur's public schools. I wanted the teachers to work with the Children's Museum of Illinois to get some background and training, and then come back to the schools and come up with some problems to solve using little bits and make some inventions, said Harding, who had to scale back her dream due to the cost of the idea. She's the instructional coach at French Academy. However, she did get a grant from the Decatur Public Schools Foundation and a partnership with the Children's Museum and Millikan University, which offered to provide an intern adequate to provide third and fourth grade students at French and three classrooms at Durfee Magnet School with Little Bits. Little Bits is a gizmos and gadgets kit available in configurations aimed at ages up to adults to allow inventors the freedom to make many different projects. One kit on the company's website is described as suitable for professional musicians to create new instruments. The Children's Museum uses Little Bits in its Make Space, which is also what Harding is using it for at French. The parts include battery-powered connectors, lights, motors, fans, switches, and extensions, which attach together by magnets, making it easy to connect and disconnect a variety of parts. It can be as simple or as complicated as the inventor wants it to be, and then easily taken apart and put away for another day. Harding has one for her family at home, which is where she got the idea to introduce it to her students. French is an STM school, science, technology, engineering, and math, and solving problems and making inventions is a prime STEM activity. Harding hopes to encourage students to come up with their own problems to solve, and the first one they worked on was how to get the teacher's attention if a child is shy about raising his or her hand. The kids went to work and came up with various things from flashing lights to a paper hand waving. The students visited the Children's Museum new makerspace to learn about the Little Bits, said Rita Ellis, instructional technology coach at Durfee. They are to use the Little Bits to solve a problem that exists in our world. Durfee students have begun mini challenges in order to prepare. The Children's Museum will be out to visit at the end of the month to see our progress. Innovation and creativity are the heart of our business, said Jennifer Walker, Communications and Community Affairs Manager of Tate and Lyle, a museum partner. Projects like this one inspire the next generation of great inventors, and we're happy to play a part in fostering curiosity, cooperation, and, of course, fun. Next article from the local pages by Tony Reed, staff writer for the Herald and Review, from Decatur, titled "Macon Resources, Inc. on a Roll." And the subtitle is "Bowling Fundraiser Strikes Right Chord on Super Sunday." More than 100 players spent Sunday enjoying the Super Bowl of Bowling for a good cause at Decatur's Spare Time Lanes. Spare Time hosted the MRI Bowl-a-thon, which, based on past performances, looked set to raise at least $10,000 to aid children's programs run by Macon Resources, Inc. This was the Bowl-a-thon's 30th year, and teams of four from companies, clubs, and organizations paid $80 each to participate in a day's intensive bowling. Having fun was clearly the order of the day, and no one cared how much of a threat they posed to the pins. Prizes were handed out for teams that did the best job of extra fundraising. "Well, it's Super Bowl Sunday, and we're calling this the Super Bowl of Bowling," said Macon Resources Executive Director Drew Lewandowski. "Why do people come out to support us on Super Bowl Sunday? I think they know how important our services are to the community." Those services affect some 450 children from birth through 18 who are living with autism or a wide range of intellectual and physical disabilities. Macon Resources programs include daycare and after-school and summer programs to enrich children's lives and help them deal with the world around them. Other programs, such as Bright Start, work with children from birth to age 5 in their homes to assist their development and help prepare them for school. Lewandowski said Bright Start gets financial help from state and federal government grants, but Macon Resources leans heavily on private fundraising to cover gaps elsewhere. "It gives us a little bit of an edge to do a higher level of programming," he added. "And in the case of our therapy services, it helps because they are not reimbursed anywhere near what the cost of the service is." The work of Macon Resources is so respected that some players taking part Sunday wanted to help, even though they live outside the area covered by the nonprofit organization. A prime example was the McPeak family from Morrisonville that included Robin McPeak and husband Chad, along with several keen McPeak child bowlers. "We're here because it is a good cause," said Robin McPeak, 31, "and it gives our kids a chance to do something in an environment where they can help others. And it's fun, too." The article is accompanied by two photographs. One shows Drevin Schaefer, 17, part of a National Honor Society bowling contingent from Argenta Oriana High School, winding up at the MRI Bowl-a-thon at Spare Time Lanes. The other shows 8-year-old William McPeak of Morrisonville taking a run at it before launching his bowling ball. And now an article written by Sharon Barraclough for the Herald and Review. This comes from Shelbyville. Mentor Programs helps Shelbyville youngsters. Main Street School principal Shannon Schallenberger knows that some of her young students have more than reading and math class on their minds. "We have students who don't get good meals outside of school, kids who don't have running water sometimes in their homes, children who don't have an adult that has the time and the interest to simply listen to them," she said. "It makes a difference in how they do in school and even how they will do in the future." Schallenberger and Main Street's teachers and other staff provide clothing, shoes, school supplies, and even haircuts to students in need. But when the women's group of the Next Door United Methodist Church offered to get involved, she saw a need for something beyond coats and shoes. "Mentors," Schallenberger said. "Children need mentors." Teacher Katie Conder of Moulton Middle School had started a mentoring program there, and I thought our younger students could use mentors too. "Students and mentors meet monthly. We do it around lunchtime," Schallenberger said. "The lunch ladies pack a sack lunch for the children, and we walk across the playground and next door to the church where the mentors meet us. They've brought their own sack lunches, and they all meet, eat, and talk." Mentor Ann Campbell of Shelbyville is a retired teacher and reading specialist. She said volunteering was on her mind after retirement. "The problem was finding the right program. You want to provide some real help. I hope this can make a difference." Campbell and her first grade student talked about school, reading, and the girl's recent loss of a grandmother. "She told me, 'You live to be 100 and then you die,'" Campbell said. "I said it sometimes works out that way, but sometimes people live longer." Campbell was almost immediately able to identify some reading problems her student had. "We were able to help her sooner than if she hadn't had that one-on-one experience," Schallenberger said. "It can really make a difference." Mentors do not have to be educators, though. "We're interested in anybody who would like to give their time helping a child," Schallenberger said. They don't have to be from a church. They just need to want to help. Main Street hopes to expand the pilot program next year to include second and third grade students. I hope the mentors will continue to meet with their children over the long term, Schallenberger said. It really makes a difference for a child to have someone who will encourage them and say, "You can do this," as they're making their way. Sometimes, all it takes is someone who will listen. And now we'll move to the opinion page, first with an editorial titled, "Congress Needs to Fix Voting Rights Problems." A federal court could rule soon on challenges to North Carolina's photo ID requirement for voters, which plaintiffs claim undermines the voting rights of racial minorities under the pretext of combating fraud. A federal appeals court held last year that a similar requirement in Texas violated the Voting Rights Act. But even if these and other judicial rulings roll back photo ID laws and other restrictions that disproportionately burden racial minorities, the real solution lies with Congress. Republicans who control the House and Senate need to look beyond partisan self-interest and join with Democrats to reinstitute the requirement that, in jurisdictions with a recent history of discrimination, the federal government must pre-clear changes in election laws that could needlessly make it harder for minorities to vote. It is Congress, after all, that is responsible for enforcing the Constitution's 14th Amendment, which guarantees equal protection of the laws, and the 15th Amendment, which prohibits abridgment of the right to vote on account of race. And it is Congress that must undo the damage done to the Voting Rights Act by a 2013 Supreme Court decision that gutted one of its key provisions. That wrong-headed ruling, which struck down Congress's formula for deciding which states must get their election changes pre-cleared by the Justice Department or a federal court, left intact other provisions of the landmark 1965 law, including a nationwide prohibition of racial discrimination in voting. Unfortunately, these provisions can lead to drawn-out litigation and are thus no substitute for preclearance, which can block a discriminatory practice before it goes into effect. Texas's photo ID law was blocked by the preclearance process, but implemented after the Supreme Court's decision. Senator Patrick J. Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, has introduced the Voting Rights Advancement Act, which would automatically subject a state to preclearance if 15 or more voting rights violations had occurred there over the last 25 years, or 10 violations if one was committed by the state government itself. The bill would also require preclearance on a nationwide basis for some covered practices, including new requirements for proof of identity. Finally, it would make it easier for judges to determine that particular jurisdictions need to have their changes pre-cleared. Some argue that restrictions on voting, from photo ID laws to cutbacks in early and Sunday voting, are motivated not by racism but by the desire of Republicans to dampen turnout among groups that traditionally support Democrats. That's a feeble rationalization for what, in practice, is still racial discrimination. If Republicans are troubled by their lack of support in minority communities, they should reconsider their policies, not block access to the ballot box. And a column by Gene Robinson, "A Lot at Stake on Tuesday." Heading into New Hampshire, the race for the nomination of the once-genteel Republican Party seems to have entered a kind of Mad Max phase. It is no surprise that Donald Trump is doing his best to create political mayhem. Trump was uncharacteristically subdued Monday night when he underperformed in Iowa, getting beaten by Ted Cruz and barely holding on to second place. But within 24 hours, he was back in form, slashing and burning with abandon. Trump seized on Ben Carson's complaint that Cruz's representatives at the Iowa caucuses had cheated, falsely leading Carson supporters to believe that their candidate was pulling out of the race. The message was that if they wanted their votes to count, they should cast them for Cruz. Trump thundered on Twitter that the state of Iowa should nullify the results and order a do-over, never mind that it is the Iowa Republican Party, not the state government, that runs the caucuses. Oh, that voter fraud. You know, these politicians are brutal, Trump said at a rally. They are a bunch of dishonest cookies, I want to tell you. Cruz accused his rival of throwing a Trumper tantrum. Cruz's wordplay is never quite as sparkling as he seems to think, and his campaign maintained it was guilty of nothing except the practice of big league politics. The dispute doesn't amount to much, except in this one sense. Trump played it safe in the days before Iowa, even skipping a debate, but now he seems back to the hot mess flamboyance that brought him this far. Polls show him with a 20-point lead in New Hampshire over all comers, according to the Real Clear Politics average. He needs to win big to remain the favorite for the nomination. Cruz is riding high, of course, and can even dream of sneaking into second place in Tuesday's primary. But New Hampshire is unfriendly turf for him. Besides being the place where Trump hopes to get his mojo back, it is the state where the lagging establishment candidates, Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, John Kasich, have to do well. If they don't, donors and endorsers may begin to coalesce around Marco Rubio, the only establishment hopeful who performed better in Iowa than the polls had predicted. Indeed, such movement began Thursday when Rick Santorum, who didn't survive Iowa, gave Rubio his endorsement. Unhappily, however, Santorum struggled mightily when pressed by Morning Joe host Joe Scarborough to name one thing Rubio has accomplished in the Senate. After much hemming and hawing, Santorum acknowledged that there isn't a whole lot, but protested that the question was unfair, since no one has accomplished much of anything in the Senate in recent years. It is Christie, though, who has been sharpest, some would say most vicious, in attacking Rubio since the Iowa vote. Christie's campaign is running out of money and time, and he seems to have decided to leave it all on the field in New Hampshire. This isn't a student council election, everybody. This is an election for President of the United States, Christie said Tuesday in an attack aimed at Rubio. Let's get the boy out of the bubble and let's see if he's ready to play next week in New Hampshire. I'm ready to play. The boy in the bubble charge was only the beginning. Christie later said that Rubio acts like the King of England, called him the master of the drive-by town hall, accused him of being overly scripted, and claimed he just doesn't have any experience. Bush is taking a more indirect approach. As we have seen in the debates, he is not exactly a master of the frontal assault, but he has been cheering Christie on, calling him a great campaigner, a good friend, an effective governor. And the Bush campaign bought a full-page ad in the Union Leader, New Hampshire's biggest circulation newspaper, in which 8 leading Florida Republicans charge that Rubio is not the best choice to serve as commander-in-chief. With all the slashing and bashing on the Republican side, the Democratic race in New Hampshire almost seems reduced to undercard status, unless, of course, there is a surprise. If Bernie Sanders from next door Vermont wins the primary handily, as polls predict, nothing much changes. He and Hillary Clinton seem likely to wage a long battle of attrition. For Republicans, however, New Hampshire is political life or death. Ronald Reagan's 11th commandment, not speaking ill of a fellow Republican, is being honored more in the breach than in the observance. And then from Jonah Goldberg, also on the opinion page, Rubio charge, GOP Obama. The Republican Obama, that's the new hot attack on Senator Marco Rubio. Ted Cruz leveled the epithet at Rubio just days before the Iowa caucuses, which is a little ironic, since Cruz has been called the same thing in the past. But the leader of the opposition to Rubio, at least when it comes to this line, is actually someone not in the race. Joe Scarborough, the normally affable host of MSNBC's Morning Joe. Contrary to all evidence, Scarborough has denied he has an unhealthy obsession with his fellow Floridian. But given Scarborough's near-relentless denigration of Rubio, objective viewers might wonder if Rubio had run over Scarborough's dog or toilet-papered his house one Halloween night in junior high school. On Thursday morning's show, Scarborough launched into an extended tirade about the best ways for other Republicans to attack Rubio. Sounding a bit like an armchair general who can't wait any longer to be asked his opinion, Scarborough declared, "He is the Republican Obama, and he really is." Time magazine, Scarborough complained with more than a touch of resentment, anointed him the Republican Party's savior before he threw his first pitch. "Seriously," Scarborough added, "I have complained for years that Barack Obama was sold and marketed like a bag of potato chips, and when I have said it, every Republican has agreed with me, and I said it was a bad move for America when they had a chance to have a more experienced candidate. Even Hillary Clinton. So now Republicans are going down that road to elect a guy that has been marketed like a bag of potato chips. Good luck." It's almost as if Scarborough forgot that Obama was elected twice. Because he has a unique animosity for Rubio, Scarborough left out that his indictment applies in equal measure to Cruz, another first-time senator who hit the ground running for the White House. Indeed, Cruz has been in the Senate for even less time than Rubio. Scarborough is certainly right that Rubio's list of Senate accomplishments is short. So is Cruz's, and for largely the same reasons. They haven't been around long, and in the last year, with Republicans in control, the GOP has mostly focused on limiting any further damage Obama can do. Which brings us back to this whole Republican Obama. For Scarborough, not to mention Jeb Bush and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, the charge that Rubio is a Republican Obama is meant to be a scathing indictment of Rubio's inexperience. But that may not be the way everyone hears it. They might hear, "He's a Republican who can win." Moreover, while conservatives have rightly faulted President Obama for not being up to the job, particularly when it comes to foreign policy, that indictment isn't the one most on the right focus. Rather, conservatives have been told with good reason that Obama has been a hugely effective progressive ideologue. While Obama has been something of a disaster for the Democratic Party in terms of congressional and state offices, he still got Obamacare. He also helped steer same-sex marriage to a victory at the Supreme Court, a court where his two ideologically left-wing appointees sit. His EPA helped kill the coal industry, while he's poured billions in subsidies into wind and solar boondoggles. No Republican wants to emulate Obama's many failures, but few wouldn't love to emulate his successes in a conservative way. The point is, it depends what you mean by a Republican Obama. For instance, when Cruz was elected to the Senate, many conservatives hoped, and many liberals feared, that he would be a Republican Obama. My National Review colleague Jade Nordlinger wrote back in 2009, before Cruz was elected, "Is he our Obama, a Republican Obama? Well, he is far less slippery than our new president, but there are similarities, especially where communication skills are concerned." Every candidate's record is fair game, but by their very nature, arguments about a politician's record are arguments about the past. Rubio and Cruz, or as I like to call them, Los Hermanos Cubanos, can frame their candidacy on the future. In a year when a majority of Americans and a supermajority of Republicans think the country is on the wrong track, that's an advantage. As Washington Post columnist Mark Thiessen wrote last year, "Those who dismiss Cruz as a Republican Obama should not forget what we call Obama today, Mr. President." And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for February 8th, 2016. Please stay tuned.